Hey folks, this is Duarte Geraldino. I'll be joining you next week on The Takeaway, filling in as host. I'm excited to be here and to hear from you. You can tweet me at Duarte Geraldino. Let me know what you want to hear about. For now, here's The Takeaway for Friday, March 23rd, 2018. Take it away, Todd.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Another week, an end to another White House career in the Trump administration. Two, as a matter of fact. Earlier in the day on Thursday, John Dowd resigned as President Trump's lead lawyer in the special counsel investigation. And then in the evening, a move that's been signaled for weeks. Army General H.R. McMaster is leaving his post as National Security Advisor, and he'll be replaced by John Bolton, former ambassador to the UN in the George W. Bush administration, and during the Obama years, a fixture on Fox News. Here's John Bolton on Fox News in 2015, making his case for the United States to bomb Iran.
Just as Israel twice before has struck nuclear weapons programs in the hands of hostile states, I'm afraid, given the circumstances, that's the only real option open to us now.
Right now, or are you saying leading into the future?
No, I would have done this 5 or 6 years ago, because the earlier you strike, the more damage you can do.
John Bolton, first strike proponent, hawkish, aggressive thought leader, they call them in Washington, on foreign policy. John Bolton will now be the president's third national security advisor after H.R. McMaster and after General Mike Flynn was fired and then charged by Robert Mueller. Zach Beauchamp is senior reporter for Vox and host of Worldly, which is Vox's podcast on world politics and national security. Zach, good to have you back.
Hi, happy to be back.
Well, Zach, talk about Bolton. Many people remember him from the George W. Bush administration at the UN and from his years on Fox News. We played a bit of it there where he made a living criticizing President Obama's foreign policy. What do we need to know about John Bolton?
So there are two really important things to know about John Bolton. The first is that his hawkishness is not a random fad that he had. It is the one thing that is consistent throughout his career. I mean, there are some other things, but the biggest one. He has advocated bombing a number of different countries. He has done so over and over again, and he sincerely believes it. The second one is that Bolton is a kind of savvy and underhanded political operator and not a great boss. So he was famous for screaming at subordinates. This is part of the reason why when Bush nominated him to be ambassador to the UN, he couldn't get confirmed. There was a lot of testimony about this. And in the run-up to the 2003 Iraq War, he was credibly accused of manipulating U.S. intelligence, not in Iraq directly, but on other weapons of mass destruction programs, basically creating a sense that dissent from the Bush administration's line about WMD in Iraq would be career suicide for people. So there are credible historians who believe that Bolton is, to some degree, responsible for the fundamental lies that got us into the war in Iraq in the first place.
Now, lucky for John Bolton, perhaps, that this job as National Security Advisor does not require approval by the Senate. The president can just hire him, and apparently has. Let's talk about his worldview. John Bolton is famous for statements urging, as we heard, the bombing of Iran, and he wrote about it in the New York Times. He urged preemptive strikes on North Korea, saying basically diplomacy is useless. That's something the president has said in the past, even though he's due now to meet with Kim Jong-un. Talk a little bit more about John Bolton's worldview and how you think he's going to guide President Trump in areas like Iran, like North Korea.
Bolton believes that diplomacy with anti-American regimes, or regimes that he understands as anti-American, can never be successful. The only resolution to those conflicts, because of the nature of those governments, is war and most likely regime change. He won't always say that, but he will. He gets there eventually if you give him some time to talk about it. And that's his basic belief. These are hostile to the United States. They will pose a major threat if they are not dealt with sooner, as you heard in that clip that you just played. And the United States needs to use military force basically yesterday in trying to deal with any number of these different problems. The thing that's consistent about Bolton is he doesn't really talk about the consequences of what would happen if the U.S. bombed an Iranian nuclear facility or tried to take out North Korea's nuclear weapons, which is incidentally not possible. He just says that the U.S. could do those things, that it would be theoretically possible for the United States to set back the Iranian nuclear program. That's probably true in that case, But it also would trigger a much wider war, and it would be costly, and it would be lengthy, according to most military analysts. And the consequences, when you hear Bolton talk about this at least, just don't really figure into the calculus.
Zach, the broader view on the posture of people advising the president on foreign policy now. Just a week or two ago, we had Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, and still today we have H.R. McMaster, National Security Advisor, the so-called, and I'll use the phrase in Washington, adults in the room, calm and level-headed. Now Mike Pompeo, who's very much in agreement with an aggressive foreign policy, moving over to state from the CIA, and John Bolton as National Security Advisor. What direction does this suggest to you?
Not a good one. Pompeo and Bolton are not the people that you bring in if you want to come to a diplomatic agreement on something. They're not experts on negotiations. In fact, they're arguably hostile to, not arguably, Pompeo made rolling back the Iran deal when he was in Congress before being at the CIA. That was one of his principal goals as a congressman. He failed, but he really believed that the agreement was bad for the United States and that, you know, we need a more hostile policy towards Iran. So Trump has talked about tearing up the Iran deal, but he hasn't done it yet, in part because his advisors have told him correctly that it would be a disaster at this stage in the deal's implementation. But Bolton and Pompeo don't feel that way. They've taken aggressive postures on on North Korea, and God knows what crisis is going to come up next. And in other ones, you might have had McMaster and Tillerson being like, slow down, think about the options. These people encourage Trump's more aggressive impulses, which were often on display during the campaign.
A key question going forward with John Bolton as National Security Advisor, is the Iran nuclear deal dead? There's suggestions to indicate that it might be, and we're going to be following that story, probably along with you, Zach Beecham, senior reporter at Vox. Thanks so much, Zach.
Oh, thank you.
You'll never have to hear the word no if you keep all your friends on the payroll. The non-disclosure page sign your secret safe between those lines.
A song for the times from Death Cab for Cutie there. You know, there have been a lot of stories lately about non-disclosure agreements, especially from people who've done business with President Trump in the past, or women who say they've had relationships with him. But it's one thing to demand or pay for an NDA in private life. Reports now say White House staffers have been made to sign non-disclosure agreements as a condition of working for the administration as public employees. Now, not a lot is known about the non-disclosure agreements that current White House staffers have signed, but one of the questions here is whether they can be enforced. Is it possible to hold government officials to the same non-disclosure agreements that are typically reserved for private life? Elizabeth Hempowitz is Director of Public Policy at the Project on Government Oversight. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, President Trump was well known for NDAs in business, and we're going to talk in a couple of minutes about NDAs in his private life. But what did you make of it when you learned that White House personnel have been made to sign NDAs?
Right. So first of all, it was a little bit, it was very concerning for us at the Project on Government Oversight. Depending on how the language is written in these NDAs, which we don't know, you know, the only reporting has been done on some earlier drafts. So it's hard to say what went into these final documents that were signed by White House employees. But at the very least, we see this kind of move by the administration to be chilling of speech that's allowed. So whistleblowing speech, and also, you know, all White House employees still have their First Amendment rights. And so the right to free speech. So at the very least, the fact that these NDAs exist, and if employees had to sign them as a condition of employment, I think that's also very concerning to us as well.
So how do these NDAs typically work, and what happens when you apply that principle to the public sector, to government?
Right. So we haven't seen these types of NDAs with White House employees as far as I know. So this is kind of uncharted waters. I think one aspect of, or one instance where we are familiar with NDAs in the government context is when there's a whistleblower settlement with an agency. Oftentimes, you know, before a case is litigated, the agency and the whistleblower will settle. And oftentimes an NDA is part of that settlement agreement. And but that's very targeted. But this type of the NDA that we're talking about now at the White House is a whole different beast. You know, it's not about a specific instance or set of events. It's kind of ongoing and forward looking and not very narrowly tailored, and as we've seen reported. And so I think that's, we are really in uncharted waters here. And so it's hard to compare this to anything that we've experienced before.
Ongoing and forward looking and not very narrowly tailored suggests sort of a broad NDA. You will not discuss anything about your employment here at the White House?
Yeah, that's kind of that's what we've seen reporting kind of pointing to, and is one of the reasons why we're so concerned.
Well, a lot of the reporting also has suggested that White House lawyers, including White House counsel Don McGahn, knew that these agreements weren't enforceable even as they slid them in front of prospective employees.
Right, which is also interesting. You know, what's the point? What is the point then if they're not legally enforceable? I think the point then is to chill speech, and that's something that, you know, we have great concerns over. And kind of, you know, you don't even need to be able to enforce this if some of the damage has been done. You know, if you're kind of sowing the seed of I can't talk to anybody about what's going on, including, you know, members of Congress who, or you know, members of the press. If it's, and I'm talking about in the world of unclassified documents here. So this kind of, you know, even if they're not enforceable, but they're meant to kind of send the message that you can't talk about what you see here, I think that kind of gets in the way of that oversight that the American people deserve over what's going on inside the White House. You know, when you're the president or you work at the White House, you work for the American people. And so there's a level of oversight and there's a level of insight into what's going on at the White House that the American people are, that they deserve.
You mentioned secrecy around classified and sensitive information, and I think people understand that kind of secrecy in the White House. But what about executive privilege? There are other rules that protect the president from having his conversations or documents leaked out, not only to the press, but even to members of Congress in their oversight role. How is this different from plain old executive privilege, which we've been hearing a lot about lately?
Right. I think this is kind of taking the concept of executive privilege and applying it to much broader than it's intended to. You know, the president is the only one who can exert executive privilege. And so I think one thing that we at POGO have been frustrated with is watching, you know, representatives of the administration or former representatives of the administration testifying in Congress and kind of alluding to executive privilege. So not exactly claiming it themselves, but kind of, you know, talking about maybe the president would want to claim it in the future. And that, I think, that enforcement of the idea that only the president can claim executive privilege kind of falls on Congress there, because these individuals don't have that right. It's not their privilege to exert. But no, this is, I would not say that this is a routine use of the executive privilege.
Well, Elizabeth Hempowitz, I don't know if you're going to offer any legal advice through the airwaves of The Takeaway, but I know you're all about disclosure. If there's a White House employee listening who's working on a tell-all book or wants to talk to public radio about their experience and they've signed an NDA, can you tell them to just have at it?
I definitely wouldn't give that kind of legal advice over the air, but you did raise an excellent point earlier, and that was whether or not these NDAs are even enforceable. And I would tell those White House employees to take a good hard look at whatever they signed and kind of make that decision for themselves or speak to a lawyer about that.
Elizabeth Hempowitz, Director of Public Policy at POGO, the Project on Government Oversight. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, despite the legally questionable strategy of using non-disclosure agreements to silence White House employees, private life is another matter. And now people from President Trump's past are working to break the silence imposed by NDAs that they signed. Adult film performer Stephanie Clifford, also known as Stormy Daniels, is trying to break out of the NDA that she reportedly signed with President Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen during the presidential campaign. And in a different legal situation, another woman, former model Karen McDougal, is suing the media company AMI. She's trying to regain control over the story about her alleged affair with Donald Trump. Now, McDougal sold that story to AMI, which publishes the National Enquirer and whose chief executive is a friend of President Trump's, in August of 2016 for $150,000, and she told that story on CNN last night. The lawyer for Stormy Daniels, Michael Avenatti, rejected the notion that her challenge to her NDA is politically motivated. Here he is on CBS earlier this month.
This isn't a publicity stunt. I wouldn't be wasting my time or staking my reputation on it if it was a publicity stunt. We believe the NDA will be tossed out. We believe that it will show that Mr. Trump never signed either document, and therefore she's free to tell her story.
Deborah Katz is a civil rights attorney and founding partner of Katz, Marshall & Banks, and she joins me now. Deborah, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, in private cases like this, private life where ostensibly people sign NDAs voluntarily or they're paid to do so, how do these NDAs work?
Well, there's sort of two types of NDAs. They're the type of NDAs when someone goes into a job, like in the Weinstein Company is an example, that employees, just as a condition of working there, have agreed not to say anything about their employer, their personal lives, etc. And the Trump Organization requires its employees to sign that as well. Then there's a second type of NDA, which is when someone, like Stormy Daniels, enters into a settlement agreement. They agree to not disclose or not disparage the person that they're entering into the contract with. In the first case, I think it's extremely heavy-handed. It sends a chilling message that no one is allowed to speak, even if there are serious lawful violations going on, like in the Weinstein case, where everybody was too scared to speak out about very, very serious and egregious sexual abuse and serial sexual predation.
You know, there's the gray area and a borderline that seems to be revolving, especially around the Stormy Daniels case, about whether the NDA that she signed was completely voluntary, you were paid money and you signed it, or whether there was a form of coercion, legal coercion, you better sign this thing or there might be trouble for you. How does the law, how do judges look upon sort of that gray area?
Well, I think we'll learn more on Sunday night, but the suggestion has been that she signed this under duress. Duress is a very high legal standard. Essentially, the courts look to whether you've had threats or literally a gun to your head to sign an agreement like that. The better argument and the one that they're pursuing is that there is not a valid contract that was formed because President Trump, who claims to be the beneficiary of this agreement, did not sign the agreement himself. So those are how these issues are shaping up. Now, she did take the $130,000. She's offered to return it. But there's a lot of legal maneuvering going on about that. As a practical reality, everyone's violating their NDA. It doesn't matter what any court rules. They're already doing it.
Well, Deborah Katz, the process to get out of an NDA, one of the interesting factors here is that as there are lawsuits and countersuits, there's the possibility of discovery, that once you're disputing the NDA itself, the lawyers get to work about finding the facts of the case. And through that discovery, the facts of the alleged affair could come out anyway. How important is that?
Well, look, I think we're hearing the facts of the case regardless of what any court rules. I mean, there's self-help going on here. If someone tries to invalidate an NDA by saying that there was coercion in the formation of that contract or there were threats that led the person to sign the contract, a court is going to have to allow some discovery to find out what those underlying facts are. So there is a potential for discovery as to those facts, but whether or not an affair existed may not be relevant to whether there was actual duress. I think the reason that people are going forward and telling their story publicly is it makes it less important to sue them to enforce the NDA. The story's already out there.
The story's already out there. And these are civil actions. These are torts. These aren't criminal questions. So Deborah, you know, it occurs to me that once there's enough money on the table, either through media interest in a story or tell-all books as a possibility or just the celebrity that comes with a case like this, the threat of being sued for breaking an NDA kind of goes away because you'll get that remuneration back somehow, at least the threat of breaking the NDA and what can happen if you do.
That's right. The other thing is that courts can invalidate the penalty clause, the liquidated damage clause of an NDA if the court finds that it's punitive. It's designed to penalize and punish, not to compensate for the breach. So in a situation where they're claiming to sue Stormy Daniels for $20 million for breach, good luck on that. I think a court could easily say the woman got $130,000, and in exchange, he gets an agreement that he could sue her in perpetuity for the rest of her life for $1 million per breach. I think a court will find that that provision is an improper penalty, and for that reason, that provision is invalid.
Now, take a moment before we go, Deborah, and talk about the NDAs that were made infamous as part of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. That company has gone bankrupt. They've said that those NDAs will now be invalidated. And the message there being that these were coercive NDAs. These silenced women from sharing their stories of abuse.
That's true. And it's good that the Weinstein Company is finally letting these women out of their NDAs. But people have been asking for that since October. So it's a little bit late in the game to give people an opportunity to talk about the abuse that they experienced. The reality is that many women for decades were so terrified of Harvey Weinstein and what he would do to them if they violated the NDA that they stayed quiet. And you had a culture of abuse, rape, and serious sexual harassment that was allowed to continue. These NDAs are no good, and they violate public policy. And you are starting to see states like Washington State saying that employers cannot do this to prohibit people from talking about sexual harassment. And I support those efforts.
Deborah Katz, civil rights attorney, founding partner at Katz, Marshall and Banks. Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Back in January, the head of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald, left that agency after reports of financial ties to tobacco companies. Well, this week, the Department of Health and Human Services announced her replacement. It's Dr. Robert Redfield. Now, Robert Redfield is a longtime HIV and AIDS researcher and physician, but his appointment is drawing some scrutiny to work he conducted during earlier parts of the AIDS epidemic. Sheila Kaplan is a public health reporter for The New York Times.
Dr. Redfield has been researching HIV, AIDS for over 30 years. He's also been working on policy, especially AIDS policy in the military. And he's very well known and in most quarters, very highly regarded for his work in the U.S. and in Africa and Haiti. I think some people who have worked with him in the past have very long memories, and there was an incident back in the early 90s that still troubles some of the people who worked with him then.
Let's talk a little bit about that incident in the 90s. Robert Redfield was accused of scientific misconduct over exaggerating results of a HIV vaccine trial. He was cleared, but people still think it's a blight on his record.
Yes, the military investigated Dr. Redfield for allegedly cherry-picking his test results. And by that, I mean picking out the people who did very well to make the treatment vaccine look like it was a sure thing. And some of his colleagues working at Walter Reed at that time, they felt that he was giving the public false hope for a treatment vaccine that was not yet proven. And in fact, it never did go on the market. It never did work. The allegation was that Dr. Redfield knew that it really wasn't as good as he made it sound. I talked to a couple of the people who investigated the case back in the 90s, and the people I spoke to still believe that Dr. Redfield got off too easily and that he should have been censured publicly for scientific misconduct, which the military did not do. All they did was have one of the papers corrected and suggest that he not work as closely with a certain conservative health group that he was working with at the time. And he moved on, and everyone moved on, but investigators have long memories. And one of the investigators I spoke to, Dr. Hendricks, felt that since Dr. Redfield had never apologized or acknowledged that he did anything wrong, you know, they should all still be concerned about his ethics. Many, many other colleagues and patients believe that he is terrific and that his work in AIDS has helped get rid of the stigma and that he's helped many patients have long, healthier lives.
What about Robert Redfield's positions now in the areas that CDC is responsible for?
In terms of vaccines and needle exchanges, Jesse Milan Jr., who's president of AIDS United, said that Dr. Redfield called him to tell him that he would embrace the group's goals and that he would support needle exchanges for drug users to prevent the spread of HIV through dirty needles. And he also would back their PrEP, which is the use of an anti-HIV medication to prevent getting the virus. In the past, he's made some comments about condoms not being sufficient protection, and people in the AIDS community have interpreted that as him being against condoms, and they've been upset by that. But he seems to have dialed that back.
Sheila Kaplan, public health reporter for the New York Times. Sheila, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
In 2007, there were fewer than 400 new HIV cases in the Philippines. In 2017, that number was over 11,000. That's an explosion in new cases, while worldwide, the number of cases has fallen. There are concerns that a strain of HIV has arrived in the Philippines that hasn't been seen in that country before. And meanwhile, the Philippines is a country that struggles to balance social norms with proven public health strategies that cut HIV infections. Dr. Edsel Salvana is director of the Institute of Molecular Biology and Biotechnology at the University of the Philippines in Manila.
I trained in the United States from 2002 and 2008, and when I was doing med school back in the Philippines, I hardly saw any cases of HIV. And then when I came home in 2008 to start my practice in Manila, I saw about 12 new patients in about a month, and six of them died. So that was really a mystery to me, because before that, our epidemic in Manila had been called low and slow, and suddenly there was this unusual rise in the cases. So at that time, nobody really knew what was going on, and we had some suspicion that something had changed. And through the course of research that I've done, one of the things that it really points to right now is that we've changed the molecular subtype of HIV in the Philippines.
Change the molecular subtype. Now, a lot of people have reported that to say that there's a new scary strain of drug-resistant HIV circulating in the Philippines. Is that what you mean to say?
Well, it's not entirely accurate. This is not a new strain. This is a strain that is more common in Southeast Asia and Thailand. And the Philippines is unusual in that instead of that subtype that's more common in Southeast Asia, in the past, what we've seen is the subtype in the Philippines is more similar to the subtype that is found in the United States and Western Europe, which is called subtype B. And sometime between 2003 and 2008, that completely flipped over. About one-fourth of subtypes in the Philippines before 2003 were this new strain, AE, which is a Southeast Asian strain, and about 75% of it is the U.S. or Western Europe subtype, which is a B. And after we did our study in 2013, we found that that had completely flipped. 75% was now AE, which is a Southeast Asian subtype, and only 20% is now B.
Now, some of your own research sparked reports that this new subtype was also resistant to some of the key drugs that are used in PrEP, basically anti-HIV preventative treatment. Is that a problem here as well?
Right. So what that research is showing right now is that this subtype seems to be developing resistance to the antiretroviral drug called tenofovir. And this is unusual for the B subtype that is in the United States and Western Europe. And we're seeing it as one of the more common drugs that HIV becomes resistant to in the Philippines. Tenofovir, in fact, in our research, was the second most likely to develop drug resistance on patients on antiretrovirals.
So, Dr. Salvana, that's the molecular biology part of this story. What about public policy and social awareness of HIV and AIDS? President Duterte in the Philippines has made some disparaging remarks about condoms, sending a message that maybe people shouldn't use them. So what does the Philippines need to do to tamp down on this huge rise in new cases?
Well, the Philippines is still a conservative Catholic country, and so we've really had some major issues trying to get people to use condoms for safe sex. I think that the fight with the church is really a problem, but you know, I think we should probably focus on the things that we can do together rather than focusing on that particular issue. So education programs, access to treatment, those are really good starts that the Philippine government is doing. But I think part of the problem now that we're rolling out all these antiretrovirals is we're seeing increasing resistance. And that's part of where the molecular biology comes in. Because even though in the United States, you guys have 28 antiretroviral agents, and we use three at a time to treat, in the Philippines, we only have six. And so at the end of a year, we see about 10% of people failing treatment, and half of those who fail treatment actually don't have a good second line because they're resistant to multiple drugs.
Dr. Edsel Salvagna, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Edsel Salvagna is director of the Institute of Molecular Biology and Biotechnology at the University of the Philippines. We return now to our ongoing coverage of the opioid crisis. Policymakers are scrambling to counter the epidemic of opioid addiction, which played a part in the overdose deaths of more than 42,000 Americans in 2016. That's according to the CDC. One key target is the overprescribing of legal prescription opioid pain medications. Now, President Trump spoke in New Hampshire earlier this week, where he unveiled his new plan to tackle this crisis at the federal level, which included this goal.
We're going to cut nationwide opioid prescriptions by one-third over the next 3 years. We're also going to make sure that virtually all prescriptions reimbursed by the federal government follow best practices for prescribing.
Well, in some states, efforts to crack down on opioid prescribing are already underway, like in New Jersey.
There is a limit to the initial supply of prescription opioid pain pills to 7 days. That's the step in the right direction, I think, but that's not the cure-all.
That's Dr. Indra Sadambi. She's an addiction psychiatrist and medical director at the Center for Network Therapy in New Jersey. And she's one doctor urging caution here. Sadambi says that too many restrictions on prescribing can actually push patients towards counterfeit drugs on the street. And those are also known as pressed pills because they've been branded to look like legal drugs like Percocet or Vicodin. They're incredibly cheap and they're incredibly dangerous.
Buying those pills is deadly, and the way they present to the emergency room, even the treating physician does not know what is involved with the kind of presentation, because it can have not only fentanyl but also other benzodiazepines in there and other kind of substances in it.
So Dr. Sadambi makes the case for a different approach to prescribing and treatment from the medical community.
Being an addiction psychiatrist, I always talked about non-opioid, non-narcotic pain pills to be prescribed initially for any kind of chronic pain. And if need be, if there is a need for any opioid pills, then we need to have a treatment plan in place. That means how long are we going to prescribe this medication, and what is the plan to take the patient off of the medication. If we don't have that in the treatment plan, then there is no point in starting somebody on pain medication, continue that for years.
There are really two sides to this, doctor, as it strikes me. These are people with legitimate pain. You want to try to prevent them from getting addicted in the first place. But really, we're talking about the hundreds of thousands of people across the country who are already addicted to prescription opioids and then might be driven to the street if there are close restrictions on the relationship with the doctor and what the doctor can prescribe. That's what you're worried about.
Yes. What's happening in reality is that the doctors are now scared to write the prescription, and they kind of say, I'm not going to prescribe you anymore this pain medication. So the patient who has been using a pain medication for their pain abruptly cannot come off of this medication. They should be referred to detox centers or referred to an addiction psychiatrist. That's not been done at all. They're like abruptly pulled out of this medication. So they are forced to go to the street looking for substitute.
These pills are so widespread. Pain is so widespread, of course, and lots of different kinds of primary care physicians, family physicians, internists across America are prescribing these drugs. But is there capacity in the medical system for each of these people to have the kind of pain management consultation, addiction management consultation that you're talking about? Are there enough people like you out there?
There are enough professionals out there. Let me first address what you said. There are family practitioners and the nurse practitioners who are prescribing these pain medications. In my opinion, as an addiction psychiatrist, I think they don't have the skills really to determine whether this kind of chronic pain needs opiate pills at all. That is the first step that we need to correct. That means a specialist should be involved when we are prescribing this kind of pain medication. It can't be just an office visit with a primary care physician, as we do it with any other illnesses. Like if someone has cardiac issues, the family practitioner is referring the patient to a cardiologist. The same way, they need to follow the CDC guidelines. It's already in place. So they need to get a treatment team together.
What does the CDC say about the way opioids should be prescribed in these situations?
It's very simple. It's a guideline which walks through the physician what needs to be done. If someone has a pain, we need to first try non-narcotic pain medication. And if that is not sufficient, then we should introduce opioid pain medication with a plan. That's a treatment plan. That means you're going to refer them to an addiction psychiatrist. They're going to have physical therapy. They're going to have alternative treatment plans in place. And so the pain medication will be having a start and an end date. And the patient should be brought in for urine screens to make sure that they are not using any other substance concurrently. What I mean by that is using benzodiazepines for anxiety and stuff like that. So all these things need to be monitored. And CDC walks the doctors through step by step. It's a great guideline.
What about the hundreds of thousands of people, maybe it's millions, I don't know, who are already addicted to opioid pain relievers and seem to overwhelm the system in any ability to get people well?
That's a big question right now. Educate them and be reassuring to these patients and slowly tapering them off of these medications by adding other non-narcotic pain medication and giving them allied help, like, as I said, physical therapies, nerve stimulation and stuff like that, yoga. You know, these things need to be, it's time-consuming, but it is doable.
Dr. Indra Sadambi is an addiction psychiatrist and medical director at the Center for Network Therapy in New Jersey. Dr. Sadambi, thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
The first Pride Parade in the United States was held back in 1970. That was a year after the Stonewall Uprising in New York City. Parades are an annual event now in cities all across the country and around the world, including for the very first time this year in Starkville, Mississippi.
We're both part of the LGBTQ plus union at Mississippi State. It's a student activist group, and we just now this year got enough members, we thought, to kind of put on something of the magnitude of a pride. I filled out the permit to have the parade. All the city officials were pretty friendly and encouraging of the parade. One of the police officers we talked to even was like, we can get the pink fire truck from the fire department. We were pretty excited about that.
That's Emily Turner, who, along with her partner, Bailey McDaniel, organized the first ever Pride Parade in Starkville, Mississippi. That's a college town. But enthusiasm on campus did not mean enthusiasm from everyone in town, including some of those elected officials.
Starkville hasn't denied any special event requests in, like, 10 years. Is that right, Bailey? Yeah,
yeah, 10 years.
So that's, like, 88 requests in a row. So we were like, it's a parade. Like, it's not going to be a big deal. This is a college town, like, they may not agree with it, but they're not going to deny our requests, right? Well, we're kind of wrong.
We're way wrong.
They did not seem excited at all about the idea of having a pride parade in their city.
Bailey, you went in front of the Board of Aldermen to get your permit processed. What happened?
Yeah, so in the Board of Aldermen meeting, we weren't allowed to speak when the item came up for the board to discuss, but we were allowed to give citizen comments. So I was the first one to speak, and I tried to just explain kind of the state of LGBTQ plus students at Mississippi State. So like 10 years ago, if not sooner than that, there was a secret knock to get into the meetings that LGBTQ plus students would have because they were afraid of like meeting backlash or people being really rude or just being violent towards them. And I tried to explain how like that has grown in the last 4 years and how we didn't have to knock anymore, but we needed to continue to not have to knock in the city because we were going outside of the university and going into the city. And it was really vulnerable for me to go in front of them and be like, hey, I'm openly part of this community. I'm trying to do this event. And the thing was, is they wouldn't even look me in the face.
So they denied that first application. Some advocacy groups got in touch with you. An injunction followed. And then what?
We heard from people all over the country. Mm-hmm. Some people from Illinois reached out to us. They were like, the same thing happened to us. We just want to offer our support. We heard from people from Florida, New York,
Atlanta,
California.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a bad thing, but it ended up making Pride better.
And bigger than ever.
Yeah,
than we could have
ever imagined.
Now, we should say the lawsuit was filed, the injunction was filed, and then the alderman came back and voted again. Talk about that.
We filed the lawsuit, so the meeting happened on Tuesday, and we filed the lawsuit that next Monday. the board, I guess they thought that the insurance for the city was going to cover it, but I think they got pretty scared about how much it was going to cost them, honestly. And so one of the aldermen put the parade back on the agenda for them to discuss it again. And that meant that the next Board of Aldermen meeting, which happened to be the next Tuesday, they would have to discuss it again. And when we got into that meeting, I was not expecting them to change their mind. Yeah. They knew the repercussions of their decision the first time, and they still made that decision. So I thought we were going to go in there and be humiliated again. But one of the aldermen abstained. He was like, I still uphold to my moral beliefs or something like that, but he was going to abstain.
Because it was better for the city, yeah. He said.
I don't think you can view it as they learned from the error of their ways. They just were afraid of the money it was going to cost them.
Yeah.
Well, what has community reaction been like outside of the deliberations of the Board of Aldermen? What have people said to you?
People will just stop us and be like, I love you guys. You're amazing. Oh my God. Yeah, thank you for everything that you've done. Congratulations. Yeah. Like people I've never met before. And even people I don't think Emily's met before, and she's from here. So just the outpour of support and love has been amazing. And so many people have been like, anything that you need, let me know. I'll be there at 6 a.m. on Saturday to help you set up.
Yeah.
People will go into a restaurant and people will sit down and just like thank us. And I think for me, the most poignant thing that's happened is the high school. So a couple of kids from the high school came to a meeting that we had right after the board denied the parade the first time. And one of them, her name's Emma, and she spoke at the next Board of Aldermen meeting. And we had 25 seconds left and in our side of citizen comments. And she walked up there and she was like, my name is Emma. I'm from Starkville High School, and I'm here on behalf of all of the students who are too afraid to stand in front of you guys. And we've had so many kids, and I know that we're still kids, but like 16, 17, 18-year-olds being like, I didn't even know that gay people existed in Starkville. And I'm part of the community, or I think I'm part of the community, and it's just like so great to see this, to know that I don't have to leave to be accepted. I don't have to leave to find people who are like me. And yeah. That, to me, has just, like, brought me to my knees every time I hear it.
I mean, I used to be one of those kids, so it's, like, amazing that we've been able to kind of
help
them, because I know that's kind of one of the reasons that I wanted to come to Mississippi State, is to, like, make it better for those kids who are kind of, like,
questioning and worried about their identity.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about that a little bit more, because you both have roots in Mississippi. This is home to you. And Emily, like you said, you're from Starkville. This is your town. And I guess you could have been that kid, or maybe you were that kid in high school.
Yeah, I definitely was that kid that didn't really come out in high school, didn't want to be gay, I guess, and didn't know that there was a community in Starkville that I could reach out to for acceptance and just kind of to talk and be comfortable. When I came to Mississippi State, I realized that there was an LGBTQ community there, and I was really excited. And now we're all kind of banded together in Starkville Pride. And that's also been one of the best parts about doing Starkville Pride, is meeting the adults. I mean, I know we're adults technically, because we're 21.
But not really.
But yeah, so meeting the adults who've offered their support. Lots of professors have worked with us. Kind of our mentor through everything has been Patty, and she's a professor here. Anything we need, she's always there. Like, if something happens and we're like, Patty, what do we do? She always knows what to do. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's been my favorite part probably of the whole thing, besides helping the high school students, is getting to know older gay people in the community who I didn't know before.
Well, have you two ever been to a Pride event before?
No,
we haven't.
No.
It's so funny. We traveled this summer and we were like 2 or 3 days away from every single Pride in every single place that we were
city,
at.
Yeah. Like in Sao Paulo, we missed Pride by like a few days.
For a lot of people in the LGBTQ community, they sort of describe their first Pride almost in sacred terms, you know, a rite of passage for a lot of people. For some, it's a protest, but certainly something that when you talk to people, you know, they say they're never going to forget. And for you two, your first Pride event is one that you fought for and you planned and you're putting on, for the first one in Starkville.
I grew up in a really small town. It was super conservative, and not that conservatism is bad, but it was just really closed-minded, and you didn't know that other people existed outside of like white cisgender, just Christians, honestly. And for me, like, I've been at State for 4 years, and I'm the first person in my family to go to college, so I didn't know how to do college. I didn't know how to do this. I didn't know how to navigate anything, so I just thought that if something was wrong, you went to someone and said, hey, this is wrong, this is not okay, can you explain why this isn't okay? So I've kind of had a reputation of just knocking on everyone's door and being like, this is really messed up, can you fix this, can you explain why this is something? Yeah. So to me, this is, it's going to be more sacred of an experience because I'm graduating in May. And hopefully going to law school. So this is going to be like my last big hurrah in Starkville and in Mississippi. And it's something that isn't widely accepted, isn't common here, but I know is like important. The culmination of the last 4 years for us. So Section 93 of the first Pride flag is coming. It's from Key West. The people in Key West have it. And I was contacted by this guy named Mark, and he was like, Section 93 was the 24-foot long, 17-foot wide flag that was on the steps of the Supreme Court when Edie Windsor took down the Defense of Marriage Act, which her attorney is our attorney, which is just crazy, the coolest right? thing. It was the flag, the huge pride flag on the steps when Obergefell versus Hodges came down in 2015, which legalized same-sex marriage. So we're going to be carrying that. Like 25 people of our closest friends are carrying that flag, and it's about to be inducted into the Smithsonian. So this is like the last march that it's probably going to go on, or one of the last marches. And to me, that's just, it makes me clam up and like cry, because that is a flag that so many people have touched and been influenced by that we get, because we're making history here. I don't really know how the parade is going to go. We've kind of handed that off to some of the bigger adults to handle the logistics, but I'm just really excited. And Emily and I are grand marshaling, so we're going to carry the
banner at the
big
front.
Starkville Pride Persists banner at the front and
yeah.
be followed by
everyone.
Bailey McDaniel and Emily Turner, the organizers of the first ever Starkville Pride Parade in Starkville, Mississippi. Bailey, Emily, have fun.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
There was Parkland, and then there was Huffman High, and Great Mills High, and others.
Enough is enough! Enough is enough! Enough is enough!
Students say enough at a march for gun control that they say is a march for their lives. That's next time on The Takeaway Podcast.